into the final hour with my guest, Jonna Mendez, talking about the Moscow rules. She was in charge of disguises for the CIA office and put that expertise to work in the field in some pretty dramatic ways. Going to have her tell those stories in a moment, and then we open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments here on Coast to Coast AM. Jonna, in the last segment, you mentioned that while the Russians are still a challenge, and I would assume the Chinese as well for CIA, you're also the agents that are working now, officers working now, take on terrorists and cartels. And there was a story I've heard you tell before about putting your expertise with disguises to work in a real-life situation against involving terrorists. It involved a guy who calls up, I guess, a CIA station, presumably in the Middle East somewhere, and offers to provide information. And there was some nervousness about going to meet the person. You know the example I'm talking about?
Oh, I do. Yeah. It was, I always have to be, I never identify exactly where we were talking about, but I was visiting, I was visiting at one of our stations on a completely separate matter. It had nothing to do with this operation. But while I was there, our chief of station got a phone call from a terrorist who knew his name, who had somehow dealt with him once before, and now this man is telling our chief of station that he wants to meet with him, that he has information about an American plane that is going to be hijacked. Well, that's one of those situations where you can't not meet and collect the information. That's a life and death sort of thing. But our chief of station knew that this guy was a very dangerous, seriously dangerous man. He had already brought down an American plane himself. So he didn't want to go, but he had to go. And he said to me, okay, I need you to disguise me in such a way that this man will not recognize me until I actually can size up the situation. If it looks safe, then I'll step forward and talk to him. Our chief was a tall, blonde man with a very pockmarked face. He was distinctive. He was really quite tall. So I had to get out to the local bazaar, buy him some local clothes, put him in some sandals made from recycled tires. He was wearing a kind of a shalwar kameez sort of thing, darkened his hair, gave him some glasses. But most importantly, I gave him a cigar, and I gave him a portfolio. And I said, here's the deal. You walk into that hotel. This was a Western big chain hotel, big fancy hotel. I said, you walk in like you own the place. I mean, just that's your demeanor. And he had always said, and it was true, that you could put a terrible disguise on someone who had acting capabilities and it would work. Or you could put the best disguise in the world on someone who was afraid or timid and they could see right through it. Well, this guy must have been a thespian in his heart because it was wonderful. So I disguised everybody else in the station. There were seven of us. We all went to the hotel. Everybody had a position. Chief of station said, I'm not going in there alone. I'm not meeting with this guy alone, and I am not leaving with him alone. So we were scattered around the lobby. I was in a bookshop with glass walls, and I could see the lobby. I'm making these poor people roll out these rugs. I'm counting knots. I'm keeping an eye on the lobby. And I looked up inadvertently through a glass wall, across a hall, through another glass wall, and there was a man I had never seen, but I knew it was him. That was the terrorist, and he's standing, staring straight at me, and he's got with him a guy on each side, and they've got Kalashnikovs. They are armed. And I thought, you know, this just might be when they shoot me, because he saw me. I knew he saw me. You're never supposed to make eye contact. That's one of the rules. He saw me, and he told the chief of station later, he said, I've made about four people in here. I know are your people. This guy, as it turned out, was fleeing from his own terrorist organization, from the local law enforcement people, the local police. He had Interpol after him. I don't know what he had done, but the whole world was trying to find him and arrest him. And he was thinking that maybe somehow he could leverage some information with our chief of station. He was a desperate, desperate man, and I knew that. Well, he didn't shoot me. They didn't shoot me. But I had this brief vision that I was going to be one of those stars on that wall at CIA headquarters. Oh. And I remember that I was just stunned by the fact that it wouldn't be personal. They wouldn't shoot me because of something I had done, or because they would just randomly shoot you. I mean, it was just that kind of Wild West environment that we were in. It was really scary.
It's a, you know, it's one of the
local police arrested him the next day.
Hmm. One of the Moscow rules is to trust your gut, right? A lot of what you do in the field and what Tony did and the other officers is to trust their gut, call it intuition.
Absolutely. You know, one way to translate trust your gut in Moscow was, if it felt wrong, you didn't need any excuse to abort your operation. If it didn't feel right, don't go. Because if your gut is telling you something's wrong and you go anyway, you may have just killed your agent.
Well, there's a very specific example of that. I'm trying to remember the young woman's name, Marty, I think, where she
Marty
has a
Peter.
Feeling that something is wrong.
Marty knew something was wrong, but Marty didn't kill her agent. Her agent, Trigon, had been arrested before Marty even walked out her door. He was arrested. What Marty knew in her gut, she knew something was wrong. She didn't know what. She took every precaution that you can take. She went. She wasn't going to meet him personally. She was just going to put something down. And they were waiting for her, the KGB. They were waiting in the shadows because they knew someone was going to show up. How did they know? Because they had already arrested her agent. They had stripped him down to his underwear. They had, he had told them, he said, you know what? I'll write a confession for you, but I want to use my pen. It was some big status, some big fat pen, a Mont Blanc pen or something. Give me my pen, he said. I will write this confession. So they gave him his pen. But inside that pen, we had concealed, on his insistence, a cyanide pill. He had told us if he ever was arrested that he wanted the option of taking his own life rather than let the KGB do to him what they would want to do to him. So he sat there at his desk in his underwear, got his pen, bit down on the end of it, crushed the cyanide pill, and said he was dead when he hit the floor. But Barney didn't know that. That had already happened. That had already happened. That's, they got his notes. That's how they figured out someone was going to come and meet him at this bridge on a certain day at a certain time. And they were waiting, and they were stunned that it was a woman. They were stunned because they never used women, ever. That's why we had a woman handling that operation. It was another form of cover. They never
there are
expected that it would be a woman.
There are stories in the book it sounds like straight out of the X-Files, where the arrangement is that the operative who's to be in contact with your officers would leave a signal, leave the window open.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The KGB, I guess it was onto it, had nabbed him, and they actually left the window open, but they left the wrong window open.
That's right.
That's the case where the guy wanted cyanide. He had cyanide, but he didn't take it to work with him when he got nabbed.
Yep, that was Tokachev. He didn't have it on him. He had it with him. He had it in his holdings, in his house, but he didn't have it with him. There was always a story floating around Moscow that what the KGB would do if they got you is that they would put you into a crematorium, feet first, alive.
Oh.
I thought that story was just to dissuade Russians from considering working for the West. But I don't know. That may be what... It would certainly be a deterrent, right? If you heard the story.
Absolutely.
These Russians that worked with us, they were heroic. They were fighting the odds. They all knew that. They were in a society where everyone was spying on everyone.
Well, again, that's what I was going to say. My two trips to Moscow in the 90s, it was, was it perestroika, glasnost, a new age of openness, but still there was a sense of nobody knew who to trust. The Russians were pretty careful about speaking to Westerners. And then that was in 93. In 96, by the time I got back, it had changed. It was already, there was a cloud hanging over the country. They were worried about the direction. The bad old guys were coming back in, and now I would think it would be pretty foolhardy for Russians to cooperate with Westerners without getting fear of being caught.
Well, you never know, because the ones that are truly motivated by whatever is driving them, and something is driving them when they're working for us, sometimes that motivation is so strong that they will take all kinds of risks. Part of what made our work, my work, me personally, what made me stay there and work incredible hours and go to great lengths was the idea that we could protect these people, that we could protect those foreigners, that we could keep them safe. We could show them how to do the work they wanted to do successfully and survive. That was the goal, to protect them. Now, how many, there aren't that many jobs in the world where you can have that kind of an impact on what someone else is doing. Put them in a position where they'll be safe, where their families are safe. And if they get in trouble, rescue them. That was a big part of what we were doing when we were working, Tony and I.
I mean,
That's a great motivator.
The primary examples cited in the book, these cases where the Russians end up dead, they sort of almost seem resigned to that fate because they declined the offer to get them out. But you have other successes. I don't know that they live happily ever after, but you have successes where you extract them after they've been useful and then they go somewhere, witness protection, the equivalent of, right?
Yeah, there's a whole system set up. When we can exfiltrate them, we bring them out, we bring the families with them. There's a piece of the CIA that works to resettle them. We document them. We get them in a situation where they can live in the United States and live out their lives in comfort.
I didn't even get into some of the contraptions that have been created. You touch on them in the book about, for example, modifying vehicles so that people can be stashed inside and taken across a border station and escape any kind of detection, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's not everybody can do that. I could not do that. I'm so claustrophobic that you couldn't put me in the trunk of a car, couldn't close me up in anything. It had certain risks. And then if you're moving family, you're moving little kids. Little kids were always an issue. What do you do with little kids? You don't want to drug them, but you have to. It's a very complicated thing to bring people out. It's very complicated.
But we'll take
it was always part of the deal. We told them we would come get them. When you started working with people, you made a pact. You said we are committed. We are committed to keeping you safe, and if that doesn't work, we're committed to getting you out of here in one piece with your family.
And there's honor in that, right? In general, you have to honor it, because if the word gets out that don't honor it, then you're not going to get people to cooperate with you.
Absolutely. Like the one man in Fedora we were talking about, where the chief of station put on a lady's outfit to go meet him. By the time we got to his door and were offering to exfiltrate him, to rescue him, we already had people in Sweden on boats going to the continent. We were putting together the plan to rescue him before it had even been proposed to him. And in some instances, There was an officer named Klinsky. He was in Poland. We brought him out and his whole family. We had to update their documents every 2 years. We had to get new pictures, make new travel documents, make new identities for them every 2 years while he was working for us, on the chance that if anything happened, we had to be able to move right then. You couldn't start making the documents the day it happened. You had to have stuff on the shelf. So that was very much part of Tony's work.
The guy who was killed in England, the former Soviet operative who was killed in England, attacked with his daughter, I think. So should he have known he was at risk? Was he in some kind of witness protection type program, or was he out and about open?
I don't know. From what I read and what I heard, I thought that looked like a settled matter, that he had ended up in England with his daughter, that he had made it to the West. There's a big precedent. There's a number of Soviets that have come out and settled in England. I think that was a big surprise when that happened. I'm not quite sure why they picked him, but they did.
To make some sort of a point that we
maybe
don't
there's
know
not a real rationale for why they picked him. They picked Litvinenko. Remember that, the polonium?
Yeah, the guy who stabbed with the polonium. Was it an umbrella that was used or something? Is that something else?
Not an umbrella. They came out. They laced his tea.
Oh.
He laced his tea in a coffee house, and he spent a week and a half publicly dying in a hospital. I mean, lost his hair. He was in agony. It was just. It's hard to imagine what they thought they would accomplish. Maybe they were trying to send a signal: if you cross us, you know, we can get you, even if you're in the West. Is what we can do to you. It's that heavy-handed KGB thing, where there's no nuance, there's no discretion. It's just a coarse.
A bunch of folks on the phones. I don't want to, we got about a minute, so I don't want to cut them off, but there was something you developed in about a minute. Tell us what Disguise on the Run is, and was that your baby?
Disguise on the Run, the chief of station Moscow kind of initiated the idea, and Tony fleshed it out. It's the idea that you can change your appearance while you're walking down the street. If you have a crowd of people around you, it's even better. We did something, there's a Wired.com video that I did a while back that demonstrates it. It's actually my son in the video walking down the street in New York City at lunchtime, comes out of an office building wearing a coat and tie with a little briefcase, and in a half a block, he turns into some hipster wearing a beanie and Ray-Bans and earbuds. He's wearing a tank top. His blazer is in a bag that was put into another bag. And he's got full cuffs, tattoos on both arms. So you go from a businessman to a, I don't know, what, some kind of dude. And it happens very, very fast. And if surveillance is behind you and coming through that crowd behind you, and they're following the guy in the blue blazer with the backpack, that guy just disappeared in front of him in that crowd.
I've got to learn how to do this in my own life. I'm going to start practicing. Jonna Mendez will be right back. Then we'll talk about the Moscow rules and take some calls. Our final segment tonight with Jonna Mendez talking about the Moscow rules. Let's take some calls. Thanks for your patience, everyone. We're going to Richard in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, George. Fascinating show.
Thanks.
My question is relating to the Argo, the fictional film used for the Argo Iranian operation. The artist who created Marvel Comics, Jack Kirby, drew 13 pieces of art for a science fiction theme park called Lord of Light. And that was that art, a media kit, an investor package was used for that artwork. I've always wondered how you came to use that artwork.
You know, I can't speak to the artwork. I know that the story Lord of Light was used as the vehicle for Argo. What I had understood is that a screenplay that had been written for Lord of Light was pulled out of a stack of manuscripts that were in John Chambers' possession. He had been sent the manuscript to look at. And they basically took the cover off of it and put a new cover on it and called it Argo and set about rescuing six American diplomats.
So the great Jack Kirby was the guy, huh, Richard?
Yeah, it was after he left Marvel. He drew it in 1978 for a proposed theme park, science fiction land, in Denver, Colorado. But Barry Ira Geller, Mrs. Mendez is correct, he wrote the screenplay that they used. But Jack Kirby didn't know about its use in his lifetime, but he would have been thrilled.
I've seen the artwork.
That was my question.
Thanks. Johnny, you've seen the artwork?
I've seen the artwork, and I know that some of it has been auctioned off. It gained some extra value. Because of the association with Argo, but I agree with the caller. I think they all would have been somewhat proud to know that their efforts were part of a rescue operation that succeeded.
The name you just mentioned about the Hollywood guy who helped out, he seemed to be really jazzed about being able to participate in these operations.
There was a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of very confidential conversations because, again, it's one of those things that nobody could talk about while it was going on.
And he would take Tony around and introduce him as his army buddy or something like that?
John Chambers was the man who did the masks for the Planet of the Apes. And the technology that he used in doing that generated the technology for our mask program, which went off in a different direction. But yes, he took Tony Mendez put his arm around his shoulder and introduced him as his army buddy or as his friend from D.C. Introduced Tony to a lot of people that became very useful to us.
First time caller Dale in San Francisco. Good morning, Dale. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, George. Like your style. I was wanted to make a comment to you, your guest, about saying that the are you there, George?
Yes.
Okay. That the Cold War never went away. That was always my thought, that it never did. It's refreshing to hear somebody say that.
There are at least two of us on this line that are thinking maybe the same thought. We actually put it in the trailer of our book. The title of the book is The Moscow Rules, The Secrets, the CIA Secret Tactics That Helped America Win the Cold War. I'm not so sure right now that it's one because these things just keep popping up that make you think maybe it's just at a lower temperature.
Dale, thank you. Is that was that your question?
Yeah, well, just my comment and question that it never went away. It's always been there.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Bill in California. Good morning, Bill.
Hi, George. I couldn't help but think of a weird coincidence with the Clint Eastwood movie, The Iger Sanction, 1975, where he plays an art professor whose day job is teaching college and his night job is doing hits for the CIA.
I think I need to see that movie.
This professor had some moral qualms in the movie about what he was asked to do, and I wanted to know. I'm no liberal, but I've always been curious about people who work for the CIA. If you or your husband ever had any moral qualms, just personal misgivings about anything our own side was doing or that you saw our own agents doing that caused you to have any problems?
You know, during the time that we were there, I can remember an employee who had some problems with Vietnam. I can remember an employee who had some issues with a mail opening operation we had that was going on overseas. It was not American mail. It was foreign mail. It was operationally interesting, but this particular officer said, I object to that. And we said, great, you won't have to do anything to do with that. I think the problems came after the Cold War ended. I think, you know, with some of the torture, some of the stuff that coming out of Afghanistan, where people were maybe objecting. But in the time that I was there, the time that Tony was there, that wasn't really a problem.
Shauna, can you address the idea of whether a CIA officer in the field, and you had mentioned about how things had changed considering the targets or the opposition being terrorists and yeah. drug cartels, whether they would have the green light to take someone out? Or you can't
say? I know that the military came in and worked hand in glove with us, and that the while the CIA has always had a paramilitary capability, it is on the ascent right now, has been for a while. The paramilitary part of CIA has become a much more important piece of the agency because the target, of course, has changed. It all makes sense. The CIA was the first group that went into Afghanistan when after 9/11, and when we knew that bin Laden was going into Tora Bora. Do you realize that the military, they couldn't go in until they had a supply chain established? The CIA has no such rule. So we had paramilitary officers in Afghanistan before anybody else. They were riding horses. They were sitting on wooden saddles. They had cell phones. And they were communicating back to the United States, saying, "I have a target in sight." They were up in the hills, Tora Bora. "I have a target for you. Here are the coordinates. Now I need some hay for my horse, and maybe you could send me a real saddle if I'm going to be riding this thing for a while." It was the Wild West.
Wow, that's the. The ultimate risk for your country in that kind of a situation. It's not fun and games. And
being first in was with no supply chain. We didn't have that kind of necessity for logistics. But of course, while you're there, you have to get the materials that you need. It was a very, very tough time. Some interesting books have been written about that.
Yeah, and you can never tell anyone. And you just got to kind of keep it to yourself and get no recognition for it. It's not for everyone to do that job.
It's not.
We're going to go to Barry in South Carolina. Hey, Barry, good morning.
Hello, George. Always a pleasure, buddy. And I got a couple of good questions for Jana. But real quick, George, how in the world can MUFON have a convention in Los Angeles, 50-year anniversary, and not have you and George Norrie on the panel? I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm locked in this weekend coming up, so I couldn't do it. I got a radio show to host. So, but yeah, I got your point. What's on your mind, Barry?
Okay, pajama. Donna White and I were wondering what happened to that elephant they put in that box.
What happened? What happened to what?
The elephant, I think.
Yeah, go ahead, George. Ask her.
You know, that's one of those magic secrets. I don't know if I'm supposed to be telling those magic secrets. I would just, what if I tell you this? The elephant is still in the box. He's still there. He's not gone anywhere. He's still there. You just can't see him. It has something to do with mirrors.
Sort of to Barry's point, a lot of it is just mirrors and sleight of hand and distraction. There's one section of your book, Jana, where you're talking about it. It's a big part of what you were trying to accomplish, but it's as simple as changing a coat from one hand to the other.
Yes. Yeah. It's called a brush pass. It's all simple. It's like Santa Claus. Once you know the secret, it's not very interesting anymore. But not knowing the secret, it makes it a very effective way to transmit information. Brush
we'll try to get...
is handing something off to someone in a way that is invisible to someone who doesn't know what's happening.
We'll take try to get one more call in here. Frank in Hollywood, Florida. Good morning, Frank.
Hollywood, Maryland.
Hollywood, Maryland. Maryland.
I can't wait to get the two books, Moscow Rules and Spy Dust. I have to wait till payday to get them, but My question is, when you complete a mission and you need to be extracted from a country, and plan A fails and plan B fails, are you on your own to get out of the country, or do you lay low and wait for instructions? The second question is, let's say I'm going to use a fictional name, Harvey Lee Griswold, that's G-R-I-S-W-A-L-D, and I'm an ex-CIA agent. Would it be easy or difficult for me to get a hold of a state-of-the-art collapsible rifle with a silencer on it, circa 1963?
Wow. So let me answer the first question. Every time you do an operation, every time you plan an operation, this is the part that nobody wants to know about, because everyone thinks that being a CIA ops officer is just, you know, nonstop excitement, and it's not. It's a whole lot of very tedious planning, and part of the planning is for the exit. When you get done with the operation, whether it's successful or not, you have to have a plan or plans for how you're going to end it. How are you going to get out of the country, for instance? What are you going to do if they come over the wall after you? I mean, all of that goes in, and your operation isn't approved until you have an ending, an exit strategy. What if it goes badly? Then what do I do? You have that plan in place before you even start the operation. So that's basically, yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't all go wrong and you might get stuck somewhere. That could happen. But mostly that doesn't happen because of all those hours and hours and hours of tedious planning. The second question, sir, about the gun, I cannot tell you. I do not know. I have not got a clue.
All right. Thanks,
like
Frank,
a really
for the
good
call.
Question.
You know, Jonna, one thing we did not touch on that is mentioned several times in the book is the concept of dangles. Can you tell me what a dangle is and how the CIA tried to detect when this was underway?
It's a big problem. The Russians used to send their people to us claiming to want to work for us, pretending to be sympathetic to our cause and wanting to be picked up as active agents working for us. And it's an issue because once they gain your trust, then just by the virtue of what you're asking them to provide you with tells your enemy what it is you don't have and what it is you need. So they can use those dangles to collect intelligence. The way to weed them out for us in Russia was to insist that they provide us early on, at the very beginning, with what we called actionable intelligence. That means intelligence that would harm their country and that would give us the ability to act on it. We requested that because we knew that the Russians never would give us an agent who had actionable intelligence as a dangle. They would never send us someone who had that kind of information. That was one of the glaring holes in their system. So we'd ask them to do something. We'd ask them maybe to bring us something, to demonstrate something, to perform an act. And if they couldn't or didn't or wouldn't, we would brush them off. We wouldn't have anything to do with them.
That's a good idea for figuring it out.
Yeah.
I got a quick call here from the west of the Rockies line that sounds like somebody we want to get on the show. Bill, how you doing?
Yeah, good evening, George. I tuned in a little bit late, but I was fascinated by listening to this woman talking about the Argo situation. John Chambers was my mentor, the guy who did Planet of the Apes, and he started training me at the age of 16 to do special effects makeup, and I went on to work on Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run, things like that. And John passed away in 2001, and he had retired to the motion picture home. I was one of many people that gave a eulogy for John at the motion picture home. And I remember that three CIA people showed up to pay tribute to John. There were two men in business suits, very, very well-dressed, and there was a young woman also. And I wanted to know if this woman on the air right now was that woman who appeared to pay tribute to John at the motion picture home.
Wow, I'm blown away. No, we did not go to that service, but we did visit John at that home. And my takeaway from the home was that he had a wall of photographs of himself with Elizabeth Taylor and with Shirley Temple and with everyone in the world. But when we were there, he had a stroke. He was in a wheelchair. And he had been presented with a medal from the CIA. He's the only civilian to ever receive that medal, the only one. And he had it hanging on his wall with a little bit of white space around it. It was clearly very special. And he wheeled over to it, and he told Tony, he said, if this place ever burns down, if anything happens, he says, look, I can reach it. And he grabbed it the wall. He said, and I'm out of here. Tony Mendez said that John Chambers was one of two geniuses, real geniuses, that he ever met in his life. He had just, they were like brothers. He had the utmost respect for John Chambers.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Tell me this, Jonna. Is CIA okay with this book? I mean, obviously they cleared it. The office cleared it. But are they?
Yeah. It went through intense review. As a matter of fact, Tony was dying when they were reviewing it. And I went in and I said, you guys, speed it up. Put this on the top of your stack because he's not going to last very long. And we got the word on the 18th of January that it had passed through PRB review. I told him that, and he died the next day. He died on the 19th.
Jonna Mendez, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for sharing this story. And I hope whatever you work on next, you will keep us in mind and come back.
I really enjoyed this evening. It was fun. Thank you so
thanks
much.
Thanks very much. The book is The Moscow Rules, and it's a great read. And I'm going to see if I can learn to put some of this to work in my own life, or at least practice it. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Jan Harzan, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Michael Cosio and Anna Ramirez, Donna Walker, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galante, and producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.